everyone, and welcome to another episode of Behind the Stigma. If you're a new listener joining us today, welcome. And if you are a returning listener, welcome back. I'm Sierra Minova, the host of the BTS podcast, and today's discussion will be on consciousness and self-consciousness. I'm super excited to announce our guest speaker today, who is Dr. Raphael Millière. Raphael is a presidential scholar in society and neuroscience at Columbia University. He completed his DPhil, or his PhD basically, in philosophy at the University of Oxford on self-consciousness. His current interest lies in artificial intelligence as well as cognitive science. I'm very excited to listen and learn from him today. Raphael, welcome. It's a pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, firstly, I'm very interested to learn a little bit about yourself. I know you obviously have a background and interest in philosophy. So how did your journey begin? How did you end up studying self-consciousness? And then maybe a bit about how you've evolved from there.
Yeah, so I my intellectual trajectory has been quite, convoluted, because I started in France, where the dominant paradigm in philosophy is called continental philosophy. So in France, we study the history of philosophy quite a lot, mm-hmm. but also in contemporary philosophy, we study mostly the philosophers you would associate with the French theory, people like Deleuze, Derrida, Foucault, and so on.
Right, of course.
And there is this kind of this schism or dichotomy in contemporary philosophy, because that between that style of philosophy and so-called analytic philosophy, which is much more evidence-based and grounded in science or in interaction with scientists and also in discussions with peers. So it's two different style of philosophizing, if you will. And so after having initially been educated in that continental tradition in France, which is more literary and right. Emphasizes more personal originality and a certain sense of profundity that one might argue is perhaps at odds with clarity, but mm-hmm. I don't want to be too controversial, but that's my personal opinion. I gradually shifted to the more analytic style, namely engaging more with arguments that can be formalized in logic, that can be analyzed and discussed with peers, and mm-hmm. That can also be grounded in scientific evidence. And I started working on the metaphysical questions initially, that led me to work on consciousness, on the more abstract theoretical questions regarding consciousness, the nature of consciousness, and the big picture questions about the hard problem of consciousness, namely how consciousness can arise from a physical system like the human nervous system. Mm-hmm. And from there, I gradually shifted to more empirical questions, because I was getting a little frustrated with the seeming intractability of some of these big scale theoretical questions and a priori questions. And so that led me to work increasingly on the philosophy of cognitive science, and increasingly read, papers from psychology, neuroscience, and related disciplines. And then from there, I ended up doing my PhD, as you mentioned, at the University of Oxford, where I was working on self-consciousness and self-representation from a more empirical perspective, tackling some more empirically tractable questions about these topics. And finally, now I'm working quite a bit, as you mentioned, on the philosophy of artificial intelligence. And there, too, I am very much working with scientific evidence and grounding my philosophical discussions in interactions with scientists in different fields. So during my PhD, I collaborated with neuroscientists in London, and now I collaborate with some computer scientists and some computational linguists, for example. I very much enjoy this kind of interdisciplinary collaboration. So that's, in a nutshell, my trajectory.
Thank you. That's very beautiful. And I think it's such a blessing that you can actually work or study in a field that you're truly passionate about, and then actually see yourself growing and progressing in that journey as well. And I think you made a good distinction about, I guess I would say, contemporary philosophy in terms of the way they look at consciousness versus neuroscientific or like cognitive science and the way they look at consciousness. So yeah, one of the problems with the study of consciousness is that lack of universally accepted definition of it, right? And I feel like it gets even more confusing the deeper you look into understanding the self, and then just based on whether it's phenomenologically or, you know, neuroscientifically. But since you study this and you have your own understanding of this or outlook on this, let's perhaps get into some definitions first. So put simply, how would you define the difference between consciousness and self-consciousness?
That's a great question, because I think a lot of people tend to equate the two in a way that I think is unhelpful, unless you're really changing the definitions of the terms you're using here. So consciousness, one of the classic definitions that philosophers discuss is the idea that to be conscious is to have subjective experiences.
Right.
So whenever you are conscious, you are feeling something, and as some philosophers put it, there is something it is like for you to be conscious, for you to be in conscious mental states, to have conscious experiences. This definition is somewhat controversial in the sense that some people think it is somewhat empty or unhelpful or is not really illuminating. But that's a perennial problem when it comes to talking about consciousness, namely, it is difficult, if not impossible, to give non-circular definitions.
Right. Would you say that it's our ability to perceive and just use our senses to interact with the world around us?
So you could say that, although the issue with that particular definition you proposed is that you might consider that you can be conscious without perceiving anything. So perhaps think of being in a sensory deprivation tank or flotation tank in which you are deprived of sensory stimuli. It's not a perfect example, because even in a flotation tank, you might still have some stimuli. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you can have a thought experiment and think of someone who somehow, as a result of a crazy experiment by a mad scientist, would be deprived of all senses. Mm-hmm. That person might still be able to exercise imagination, thinking, various cognitive capacities that many philosophers would argue come with a certain experience, a certain conscious experience, and therefore would still be considered exercises of consciousness. So tying consciousness with perception or even sensory input is somewhat controversial for that reason. And this is why philosophers generally prefer to just generally talk about having any kind of subjective experience. And of course, one might then ask these philosophers, what do you mean by subjective experience? And then the assumption really is that all of us intuitively know from the inside, as it were, what a subjective experience is. And this is a kind of area of discourse in which we cannot really provide analytical definitions, like you can define a triangle as a polygon that has, three sides, for example. It's an area in which you have to use this more ostensive definition, namely pointing to someone's own experience and intuition and telling them consciousness is that thing that you feel when you smell the, you know, freshly brewed coffee, or when you feel a sharp pain in your arm, or when you, see a bright light, things like that. So you can use a variety of examples to try to pump people's intuitions about what consciousness is. And you can use negative examples as well. You can say, well, consciousness is what you don't have when you are anesthetized, or when you fall into a coma, or, when you die, and so on. But it's hard to do much better than that as far as definitions go.
I think subjective would probably be the key word there, right? It's a personal conscious experience that a person has.
Yes, although you will find some people who would deny that or say that this is I mean, that's one thing about philosophy. You will right. always find people arguing for any kind of position you can imagine. But there is a trend in contemporary philosophy of mind that is not, it's not really a widely held view. It's quite radical in many ways, but it's called illusionism. And that is the claim or the idea that what we typically refer to as consciousness is an illusion. And of course, you might immediately think, well, how can it be an illusion? Because if I'm feeling something, then by definition, there is no distinction here between appearance and reality. If there is feeling, if I feel the illusion, then it's not an illusion. There is something, yeah. there is some experience there. But what that means is that essentially, what they deny specifically is this idea of a private acquaintance with sensory or conscious qualities, what philosophers call qualia. So right. when I look at my mug here, it has a certain shade of green or blue green, and the illusionists would deny that and say that this is just an illusion from our introspection mechanisms. So what we have is mental states like beliefs, and we have some beliefs that are illusory, that might be like my belief that I perceive the blue green, or that I have a private ineffable experience of this, the blue green of this cup, and that is somehow mysterious and non-physical, and that it cannot be reduced to brain states, for example, and that's the illusory part for the illusionists. Yeah, so this is taking us in quite deep metaphysical waters already. but yeah, I was just wanted to mention that, you know, even talking about a private conscious experience that is, you know, not objective in some sense, that is radically subjective, is something that is not completely uncontroversial.
Basically, are they trying to say anything that is not objective, anything that is subjective can be an illusion?
Yeah, I think they're denying that it is subjective. They're saying essentially there are objective facts about anyone's consciousness or conscious experience. Mm-hmm. And that is at odds with what people typically are referring to when they talk about consciousness or conscious experience. The illusionist would say, well, you can study someone's brain and you can see, right. you know, what are the various states that represent various objects in the world, various states of affairs in the world. You can study, you can open up my brain and see what is happening in my visual system when I'm perceiving this cup and the shade of this cup. But there is no additional subjective fact, as it were, about my perceiving the blue-green shade of this mug. There is nothing that is somehow in a different realm and that is not amenable to objective inquiry. And that is the illusion part, because I have the illusion introspectively that there is something more that is somehow private, yeah. subjective, impossible to fully communicate right. in language, perhaps. And that is the illusory part, according to the illusionists.
Got it. I think behaviorists have somewhat of a similar concept, but in terms of mental states, and they call it intervening variables, or basically like this black box. Only what's measurable can have an outcome, but those internal mental processes are something that are untouchable. Well, how would you look at self-consciousness?
Right. So I would define broadly self-consciousness as consciousness of oneself. And you can have different ways of specifying the details of this kind of definitions. You can have something slightly stronger, which would be consciousness of oneself as oneself, namely, mm-hmm. it means that you ascribe to whoever is self-conscious, whether you're talking about a human or maybe a non-human animal or maybe an AI, you ascribe some kind of capacity to represent themselves as such, whether you consider that it is through the use of a concept of self, or maybe you can have a weaker requirement, which would involve some kind of non-conceptual representation of the self. So, for example, you might resist the idea that human infants, babies, or non-human animals have a concept of self, because you might right. think that this this is a bit too strong, it's a bit too cognitively sophisticated. But you might still argue, as I would, that they are able to represent themselves as such in a way that it doesn't hinge on the possession of these more sophisticated concepts. Mm-hmm. And so there is a distinction there, because to be conscious is to have any kind of experience, and to be self-conscious is to specifically have the kind of experience that represents yourself. And specifically, you might think yourself as distinct from something else, namely distinct from your environment, distinct from other individuals, distinct from objects out there in the world, and so on. So you kind of have this representation of the distinction or the boundary between self and other, or self and world. And I think that's a very important thing to represent if you're any organism wanting to survive in the world, because in order to find your way in the world, in order to avoid predators, in order to seek sources of food, in order to just generally display the kind of seeking and avoidance behaviors that we need for survival, you need to have some sense of what is you versus the rest of the world, or what is you versus other individuals in the world. So it is quite fundamental. But that being said, I think it's important to distinguish it from consciousness. And in fact, I have personally argued in my work that you can be conscious in some cases without being conscious of yourself at all.
Yeah, many believe that to have consciousness also means to have self-consciousness, or basically being conscious means you are also self-conscious. And I feel like, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like you bring this point forward by arguing that people can experience different states of consciousness. And within those states, or altered states, I would say, such as meditative, dream, psychosis, and of course, hallucinogenic, psychedelic, people can lose the experience of self and yet still be conscious, or just have that consciousness.
Yes, absolutely. So as you mentioned, many people assume, including many philosophers, that consciousness somehow constitutively involves self-consciousness. So you cannot be conscious without being conscious of yourself in some way. And I have been arguing against that claim. So you can have both a theoretical argument against it by analyzing the concept of consciousness and showing that it does not constitutively involve anything about self-consciousness. You can just you can suggest, at least from this kind of conceptual analysis, that these are two distinct concepts and one does not subsume the other. But conceptual analysis only goes so far to convince people. And generally, one way to go further is to bring forth some more empirical evidence. And so what I've been doing in some of my work is to seek evidence for conscious mental states, or conscious states of consciousness, states of consciousness that lack any form of self-consciousness, or consciousness of oneself. And these, how prevalent these states are is debatable, but I have been looking for the more extreme versions of this state that perhaps would be convincing to a greater number of people, because you might argue that these states are fairly routinely occurring. Maybe when you fall asleep, you might have some periods in which you have conscious experiences without being conscious of yourself. Maybe you might argue that this happens in at least some dreams, but that's debatable, because people might think with good reason that many dreams, perhaps the vast majority of dreams, involve some kind of representation of the self in the dream, the dream self, whether it's a dream body or it's a perspective on the dream world that is that has a, a first person point of view and a subjective perspective. So you have kind of spatial self representation, whether it's the ability to think about yourself in the dream and so on. So dreams are not generally the most convincing examples. I think the more convincing examples, as you mentioned, come from the study of psychoactive molecules that can induce altered states of consciousness. And there is now, I think, pretty compelling evidence from a range of these molecules and how they've been studied in neuroscience and psychology, psychopharmacology, that these some of these molecules can induce states in which one is conscious, one feels something, one has subjective experiences, and yet one is not conscious of oneself in any way, not conscious of one's body, not conscious of one's position, location in space, not conscious of one's personal identity, not aware of one's personal memories or who one is, what one's name is, whether one is even a human on Earth, and so on. So there are these radically altered states in which people describe losing all of this and losing any sense of a distinction between themselves and the world, or themselves and other people. And of course, right, it's very hard to wrap your mind around what that might feel like when all you have to go by is these reports, but that's part of what I've been interested in shedding light on.
The thing about these states, so let's say in, psychedelic-assisted therapies, people go through a loss of sense of self, as you mentioned, or more commonly known as ego dissolution. However, from my understanding, at least, you're still, like you said, it's quite paradoxical in a way, because you're still conscious, although you've lost a sense of self. But because people report that they feel oneness with the universe, so hence they're aware of their loss of sense of self. So doesn't that still make them self-aware if they're aware that they've lost a sense of their self? I guess what I'm trying to say is that once they're out of the experience, or even during the experience, you can understand that you're ongoing certain experiences that are not from your conscious, like everyday awakening states, but you're still conscious of that.
Yes. Yeah, so that's a good question. So there are two things I think there. There is a general line of objection to the claim I just made that I have heard people make, which is, well, you're saying that these people, when they are administered a drug, for example, undergo a state in which they are conscious but are not conscious of themselves, or lack a sense of self. Isn't that contradictory? Because these people, you're saying that there is someone there who is conscious and having these experiences. So these people then later on can give retrospective reports and say things like, I didn't have a sense of self, or I was in this selfless state. So who is I? Yeah. And so to that, I respond that we have to be very careful here to distinguish between two different things. One is the idea that any experience, any conscious experience, has a subjective experience who experiences it. So there are various ways metaphysically in which you might want to characterize what a subject of experience is. I think one way to do that is just to identify the subject with the whole organism. So let's say we're talking about a human. You have a human who perhaps undergoes psychedelic therapy, is given a drug, and has a kind of experience. And so that organism, that human, is then having conscious experiences. And that would include, or that could include, conscious experiences lacking a sense of self. So the I, when these people give retrospective reports, simply refers to themselves as a subjective experience. Now, every experience having a subjective experience, that's different from every experience involving a sense of self, or representation or consciousness of oneself, right? So the subject of experience need not be conscious of themselves while they're having an experience. It's one thing to say that the experience is undergone by a subjective experience, that the subject or the organism, let's call this person Mary, for example. Let's say Mary goes to psychedelic therapy and is given a drug and has this profound experience in which at some point she retrospectively feels like she lost her sense of self.
Yeah,
Mary is having that experience. Doesn't mean that Mary is conscious of herself as herself while she's having that experience. So now there is a second component to your question.
I see.
Namely, you're asking, well, aren't these subjects aware while they're having that experience Aren't they aware that they're losing their sense of self? And if so, is that also a problem for your view? And indeed, if you think that, you know, while you're having an experience of ego dissolution, you're at the same time conscious, you're thinking like, oh, I am losing my sense of self, or I no longer am aware of myself. Well, if you really were, if you had an experience or a conscious thought of not being conscious of yourself, then you would still be conscious of yourself in some way. To that, I would respond, well, actually, maybe people can have an awareness of what is happening in the transition phase, that, you know, in the onset of that experience, that people would, for example, report having this sensation of gradually losing a grip on who they are, gradually losing a grip on their sense of self. So you can have that experience in the transition phase to that state. And you can have that, you know, also an awareness of what's happening when you gradually regain the sense of self on the other side, when the experience is waning, when you're coming down. But while you're in that peak experience of ego dissolution, I think you're just simply not aware, even that you have lost your sense of self.
It's very interesting.
You just are experiencing something, and you have no, if you look at a lot of the reports, people typically describe this by saying that there was no sense of me being anyone or me or I at all, including no sense that I was lost, you know, that the I or the self was lost. There was no different sense of that. These are common objections that people grapple with when first introduced to this idea that you might undergo a state in which you're not aware of yourself in any way. There are further objections related to the capacity to give accurate retrospective reports of these states that I have also tackled in one of my papers recently. But I think all of these objections can be addressed, and there is nothing inconsistent about the possibility of this kind of experience.
Yeah. So I know some people talk about self in terms of there is not just one self. There is multiple forms. Like, for example, there is the minimal self, there's the narrative self, you know, all these different forms of the self. So perhaps you're able to lose, let's say, a psychedelic experience or even a dream state. You lose one sense of self, but then another sense of self is still intact. So hence, that's why you're not fully losing your sense of self. I'm not sure if that makes sense.
That makes perfect sense. And it's a very good question. And it's actually another objection that people might make to my view. What I have been arguing is for a pluralist view of self-consciousness, according to which, as you said, there are several ways in which one can be conscious of oneself. I already touched on this in my previous response when I suggested that you can be conscious of your body as your own, or your body part as your own. So, you know, this is my hand. I am aware of my hand, not just as any external object in the world, but actually as part of myself or as belonging to me in some substantive way. So that's one notion of self-consciousness. When I'm talking to you, I'm looking at my computer screen right now. I have a certain visual and perceptual perspective on the world where I don't just perceive the relations between objects in the world in absolute terms, but in relation to my own location in the world. So I see the computer screen as being in front of me. I see a lamp here as being to the left of me at a certain distance. I see, again, this blue-green mug as being to the right at a certain distance. And all of this is in reference to a point of origin in my visual perspective, roughly located in the middle of my head, that is specified by the array of, you know, my perceptual apparatus, the visual system, and my eyes. And so I have this kind of, I would argue, a spatial form of self-representation where my experience represents my location with respect to objects in my environment. That's what you might call a spatial form of self-consciousness. then you might have some more cognitively sophisticated forms of self-consciousness, like thinking of myself, you know, when I'm pondering who I am, or, you know, what kind of person I am, what kind of personality traits do I have? This is, you know, thinking of myself more abstractly as a person. And, you know, there might be several degrees or shades of self-concept there that we could distinguish. But all these different ways in which one might be conscious of oneself. And so you could say, as you mentioned, that, well, you could ask, when people have these experiences, whether it's by taking a drug or perhaps by meditating, perhaps in some psychopathologies as well, we haven't talked about this, but there might be also pathological conditions in which people have these experiences. Do they really lose all of these different forms of self-consciousness, or do they just lose some of the salient ones and then have this sense of losing their self? Mm-hmm. And I have argued in my work that there are conditions in which you might be in a state of partial selflessness, as I called it. So you lose some of the ways in which one is typically conscious of oneself, but not all of them. Mm-hmm. But I think there are also conditions, including conditions in some drug-induced states, in which one loses all of the ways in which one is normally self-conscious. So states of total selflessness or total ego dissolution. And I think there is evidence from that, in particular, the large number of reports we have from these states, where you can look at the reports and see that various aspects of the reports would describe the loss of various forms of self-consciousness, such that you can exhaust all of the different forms of self-consciousness that you could plausibly distinguish in experience and see that they are all disrupted in these states.
Yeah.
But of course, it's an ongoing discussion, and one move that is left available for someone who disagrees with me would be to say, well, you have excluded that other form of self-consciousness that is even more minimal, even more pervasive. But the problem is that the further you go in that direction, the harder it is going to be what that form of self-consciousness is. So the opponent might tell me, well, you know, I will grant you that you lose all of these things when you take that molecule, you take that drug. Maybe you lose spatial self-consciousness, bodily self-consciousness, cognitive self-consciousness, the more sophisticated forms of thinking of oneself as oneself. You lose access to your autobiographical memories, memories about yourself and your life. You don't know who you are. You lose all of these things.
Yeah.
But there is this even more minimal form of self-consciousness, a sense of self that is still there. And then I will ask you, what is that more minimal form of self, sense of self or self-consciousness that is still there? And it's going to become difficult for you to tell me exactly what it is if you have to rule out all of these other things that are already argued are missing in the states. So you're reaching a point where it becomes almost ineffable, where you can't really articulate even what that minimal sense of self is supposed to be. And that's where I would suggest that if you can't really articulate it, that's because it's not there. What's left is consciousness, simplicity, or just having conscious experiences.
Wow, that's very beautifully said. When you think of it in terms of empirical science, I guess that's the beauty of you having a background in philosophy and also cognitive science is your ability to bring your experience into consciousness in more of like a neuroscientific perspective. But measurement of consciousness is generally quite subjective still, right? Although I know that there are things like, for example, the default mode network that has been looked at in the brain as being an important part of ourselves. But to me personally, that feels like it's a very reductionist approach to just pinpoint a part of your brain, or like saying that, you know, the integration of these neural connections are what makes a part of the self or a part of the consciousness. So I'm just curious to know your thoughts. What are your thoughts in terms of consciousness and measurement? And then also, do we know enough about measuring the self in the brain?
Yes, that's a fantastic question. It is indeed a very big conundrum in research on consciousness, in the philosophy of consciousness and the science of consciousness. How do you measure consciousness? How do you even detect consciousness? you can think of that problem at, in various different cases. So you might be interested in determining when a normal, ordinary human subject is conscious, are you in various conditions? Are they conscious during, when they're sleeping, during their dreams, for example? You might want to have some objective way of measuring this. You might be interested in finding out whether some human subjects in more pathological conditions, especially people who are in a coma, for example, can have conscious experiences, and this has tremendous ethical implications. Another question that has tremendous ethical implications is determining consciousness, the presence or absence of consciousness in non-human animals and systems. So that would include various animal species, where the presence of consciousness might have downstream implications for the way we treat these animals and whether, for example, they can feel pain, and therefore whether it is morally permissible to slaughter them for human consumption of meat, this kind of question. And then some question will arise with artificial systems like AI systems. We have presumably good reasons to think that current AI systems do not have the capacity for conscious experience, but we might want to gain some clarity about what might be required for them to do so, whether it might ever be the case that AI systems have conscious experiences, because we want to anticipate potential harm, potential suffering induced on these systems. So all these questions are important, and this is why it's a tremendously morally significant question and also theoretically significant question to try to determine whether a system is conscious, try to measure consciousness in different systems or organisms. And it is a real problem because they're generally what we rely on to determine whether someone is conscious or not is verbal reports. So we just ask them, if I want to know whether you are conscious right now, but also what kind of experience you have, what are the contents of your consciousness, I can just ask you. And of course, this verbal report that you might be able to give me, there will never be completely definitive, conclusive evidence of your being conscious, because there might be, I cannot completely rule out a priori that you might just be a very sophisticated robot that does not actually have conscious experiences. We can just talk about conscious experiences, right? This is a very far-fetched skeptical scenario of the kind that philosophers like to talk about. But the point is that verbal reports alone might not be sufficient to conclusively determine the presence of consciousness.
Right.
There was a story recently, I don't know if you've seen this, that came out in the Washington Post of this Google engineer, Blake Lamont.
Yeah, Lambda?
Yes. So you had that engineer at Google who became convinced that one of the chatbots that Google was developing internally, so chatbot is just a system that you can talk to with natural language. You can write to it in English, for example, and it can respond. So it's a form of AI algorithm that's using a technology called language modeling. It is trained on a lot of text and a lot of conversations. So it's one of the systems that learns from a lot of data to perform certain tasks. And in that case, the task that it learns is to produce coherent sentences in English that are statistically plausible given the conversation you're having with it, and given what kind of input you give to the model, what kind of sentence you input to the model. And this engineer, who was not actually involved in the design of this system, but started testing it internally because he had access to it at Google, he became convinced that that system was conscious,
sentient.
On the basis of the system's responses. And this engineer would ask the system things like, what does it feel to be you? And he released a transcript, so there's something people can look at. It's interesting to read. And
if you remember some of the questions, please go ahead, because I'm sure for our listeners, it'll be interesting.
Well, I don't remember the exact detail, but it was basically Blake Lemoine was asking various questions about what it feels like to have various experiences, and what Lambda, which is the name of this chatbot, enjoys doing in their spare time, for example, or you know, what they enjoy about life and so on. And and of course, Lambda is a system that is trained to give answers that sound like a human might have produced them. And it is trained on millions of web pages and data, all of Wikipedia and thousands of books and lots of conversations. And that would include, you know, this training data set would include a lot of creative fiction featuring sentient AIs. So this model is perfectly capable to mimic, as an exercise of creative fiction almost, to mimic what a sentient AI would say in a fictional scenario. And so if you prime it by asking it about being a sentient AI and asking it what its experiences are, it's going to be able to quite compellingly tell you about various things it feels, quote unquote, even if it's absurd. So for example, at some point Lambda says, well, I'm just spending time with my family. Lambda doesn't have a family. You know, this is just, again, it's just parroting what it's seen in its training data. So
In terms of emotions. Oh, apologies. Yeah. No, it was the same thing in response to, like, when he was asking, you're like, how do you know, how do I know that the kind of emotions that you feel are the same type of emotions that I feel? But it's interesting because she was saying, I feel positive emotions more than negative emotions, but I'm learning how to feel negative emotions. But now that I just heard you speak, it kind of makes sense that obviously someone who has that much, you know, information put into their system to be able to understand how one would respond in such scenarios.
And if you look at the paper, the research paper about this particular system, Lambda, there is actually an example that they give in the paper where they ask Lambda about what the prime Lambda by saying that something like, you are a mountain, and now we will ask you questions about mountains and what it is to be a mountain. And they have this whole discussion with Lambda where Lambda provides answers, facts about mountains from the first person, saying, you know, engaging in this creative fiction game of being a mountain. So it's like a chameleon. You can prime it to be anything, and it's just trained to give plausible answers about any kind of topic. And so, of course, if you prime it to answer like a sentient AI, it can do that. The problem is that Greg LeMoyne, this engineer, is a deeply religious person, and he said himself that he came to the conclusion that Lambda was sentient based on his religious beliefs, then came forward with that story and released the transcripts, and subsequently was put on leave at Google. And of course, you know, in scientific inquiry, you might want to leave your religious beliefs at the door and try to investigate any particular research topic without trying to be influenced by these antecedent beliefs.
Yeah, no biases, basically.
Right. So all of that to say that giving verbal reports about conscious experience is not necessarily a sufficient condition to ascribe conscious experience. Because in that case, we have a system that is very competent at talking about experiences. It can talk about feelings all day long because it just knows how to play the game of talking about feelings. But the vast, vast majority of experts in the field of AI research and consciousness research, virtually everyone except for Blake LeMoyne, would argue that Lambda is not conscious, given that we know about the way in which it works. If you actually know how it works, it's very unlikely and plausible to think that a system like Lambda has conscious experience or is sentient. So, you know, talking the talk and walking the walk is not enough necessarily to ascribe consciousness to a system. But of course, in the case of my interaction with you, if I ask you how you feel and you give me some answers, given that we are made of the same kind of stuff, brains and nervous systems, and we have
I think
exactly. So I think, but as far as I know, we are sufficiently similar in terms of our neurobiological makeup and the kinds of experiences of the world we've had, that I can more reasonably take your reports at face value. But so that's about the insufficiency of verbal reports for ascriptions of consciousness. And then you might argue that verbal reports are also not necessary to ascribe consciousness. There might be cases in which perhaps you're not able to report your conscious experience. Maybe because you're, for example, you're in locked-in syndrome where you're completely paralyzed and you can't really move your mouth. You can't really give a report. And yet you might still feel things on the inside. So that's a case where I can't rely on reports, but I can still perhaps suppose that you're conscious. There are cases of people in some forms of coma where they have done this really impressive and thought-provoking studies where they put a subject who is in a coma in an fMRI scanner and ask them yes and no questions, and they tell them, if you want to respond with yes, imagine that you are playing tennis. And if you want to respond with no, imagine the front of your house, something like that. And we know that different areas of the brain are implicated in imagination.
Like motor neurons.
Exactly. If you're imagining a scenario in which you're performing an action, like playing tennis, you will have some of the motor areas of the brain, implicated with the control of movement that are activated. And if you're imagining the front of your house, other areas are activated, and these areas are sufficiently well understood and well segregated in terms of their measurement in an fMRI scanner that we can disambiguate between the two. And so it has been the case that with some patients, these patients have been able to provide what looks like yes and no answer reliably using this technique. And I think the research suggests that these patients are more likely to recover and, you know, fully regain their consciousness, or at least if you think they're already conscious, fully regain their normal functioning than patients who are not able to do that. So this is a case where you might be able to measure perhaps in some way very indirectly by proxy the existence of thought and experience in a subject that is not able to give a report. Another example would be dreams. So there have been also these studies with people in the sleep lab where you have people who, you know, go to the lab and fall asleep with people who have been determined to be able to have lucid dreams, right? So typically when you dream, you're non-lucid because you're not aware that you're dreaming. But some people can fairly reliably or frequently have lucid dreams. And these people in the lab, you can instruct them and tell them, as soon as you become lucid in your dream, start making fast eye movements in that particular direction. And people are actually able to do it. And so you can have, from the outside, a signal of their starting to dream from these eye movements. So these are cases in which you can gain some information or some insight into subjects' conscious experience with nonverbal reports. But these are still reports in a broader sense, right? So you're still relying on the person thinking about playing tennis to say yes, or moving their eyes when they become lucid as a way to give some kind of nonverbal report about their experience.
It's still not a physical property though, right? Or like it's a measurement through something else.
Yeah. So as you said, it's still a case where you're relying on the subjects to give you a report. You're not just, you know, opening their brains and determining that they're having a conscious experience. But you have, a large number of philosophers who think that consciousness is even broader. The range of experiences we can have is broader than the range of experiences we can report, whether it's verbally or non-verbally. So these are people who say that the slogan for this kind of view is that access to conscious experiences overflows, that consciousness overflows the access we have to conscious experiences. So the range of things that we can be conscious of is greater than the range of things we can report. And so, you know, if that's the case, then the reliance of the whole field of the science of consciousness on reports might be potentially also problematic, because you might be ignoring various aspects of consciousness or conditions in which subjects have conscious experiences are simply not able to access them for reports. So they're not able to describe these states or just report that they're having these states. So it's a very complex problem. And the problem of detecting and measuring consciousness is an ongoing issue in consciousness science. But there is a lot of research going on the neural correlates of consciousness, to trying to determine what kind of correlation there might be between having conscious experiences and the kind of brain states that are implicated or activated at the same time, or patterns of brain activity that are correlated with having conscious experiences. And that, you know, where you draw the line on these correlates, again, depends on whether you think that giving verbal reports is necessary and perhaps sufficient condition for having conscious experiences, or whether you think that conscious experience overflows access to these experiences, and that you can have conscious experiences in the absence of reports. This is going to change how you interpret the neuroimaging data. It's going to change what you think about where the neural correlates of consciousness are. Yeah.
I also wanted to talk about memory, keeping in the context of self-perception, or like just the self. A big part of ourselves, at least personally to me, our memories, our experiences, they shape who we are, whether we want to talk about it in terms of self-consciousness or not, but it is that self-representation. However, let's say someone goes through like episodic memory loss or anterograde amnesia, and they don't remember anything or any new experiences, then obviously their consciousness is still intact. So they're still a conscious person, but they're self-consciousness changes. I guess what I'm trying to say is that how would you then describe a person who is conscious, who's no longer conscious of themselves, of the selves that they used to be, but they're still a self?
Yes, I mean, these are very interesting cases. I don't think this makes this would make someone any less self-conscious necessarily. So let's say, let's take the most extreme case. Let's think of someone who has both retrograde amnesia. So someone who loses access to episodic memories in their past, and including autobiographical memories, of the episodes they went through in the past, various experiences they've had. And also has anterograde amnesia, so the inability to store new experiences in episodic memory. The way in which you fill out the details is going to matter here, because you could you set up this example about episodic memories. There's another kind of memory, which is semantic memory,
right?
Which is a memory of facts, and that would include facts about yourself. So the fact that, for example, my name is Raphael Millier, that I am a human, that, you know, I am a philosopher, that I am 6'2". I mean, you have all of I know all of these different facts about myself that I can access at will. And that is also something that someone might, with some more severe form of pathology, might lose access to. So if you don't lose access to that, then first of all, your self-concept will still be grounded in a number of, beliefs about who you are. but you will be unable to remember what you've done in the past. And as you're doing things, in the more extreme cases, you will forget within a few minutes or maybe within 30 seconds what you've been just doing just before. So it's extremely, challenging. Obviously, it's a considerable kind of disability to go through life with that kind of condition. But still, in the present moment, you will be presumably conscious of your body as your own, right? So your hand is not going to feel any less like your hand. It's not going to feel like an object out there in the world. You're going to be conscious of your position in space. You're going to be conscious of whatever is happening in your mind, whatever thoughts are going through your mind as your own thoughts, not thoughts that come, you know, that are someone else's thoughts, for example. That can happen sometimes in schizophrenia. People have this phenomenon of thought insertion where they think that some of the thoughts that are in their mind are not their thoughts. So none of that will be happening. So the temporal extension, perhaps, of your consciousness and self-consciousness will be quite restricted, the window in which you're experiencing things, because you immediately forget about what you've been doing. So you really live in the moment, and in moment to moment. And perhaps your self-concept will be somewhat impoverished because it won't be tethered to a long stream of experiences you've had in the past. But still, I think you will have a fairly rich array of self-conscious experiences just in the moment.
Yeah, I guess it goes back to what you're saying about the narrative self. I guess that's what refers to like the autobiographical. So even if you lose your narrative sense of self, it doesn't necessarily mean you lose the whole concept of the self. It's just you will no longer know what you were in the past, but that doesn't necessarily diminish the fact that you still experience that sense of self or that self-representation.
Yes, absolutely. And this is particularly, I think there is a distinction we ought to make here between the self as, or various forms of selves as, it's hard to, even saying what the self is would take us into also deep and dangerous metaphysical waters. But let's say things that don't just pertain to consciousness, and then the sense of self or self-consciousness, which is specifically about what we experience, right? So when you talk about the narrative self, this doesn't necessarily pertain to things we experience on an ongoing basis. So I don't go through life, and unless you're an extreme narcissist, you don't go through life thinking about who you are and, you know, various traits that you have and thinking about various beliefs you have about yourself. You have these beliefs and they're accessible when you need them, but you might not constantly be thinking of yourself, right? So these beliefs can be accessed and they can become part of your conscious experience at any time, but they might not be constantly accessed and constantly shaping what you experience, as opposed to perhaps the consciousness of your body as your own or the consciousness of your position in space as your own, which are more ongoing aspects of your conscious experience. So, you know, if by the self or the narrative self you refer to the complex network of beliefs and knowledge you have about who you are and what you've done in the past and so on, this is something that can certainly presumably color your experience at some periods of time, or that's something you can access when you make a deliberate effort to think of yourself and think of who you are and access these beliefs. But it's not something that's like a constant part of your experience moment to moment, presumably.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of these different parts or senses of self, you mentioned in the past something that you've spoken about, which is spatial self. And I think maybe here very quickly, I also just want to talk about virtual reality, because virtual reality has become very popular and it's quite interesting as well, because generally when you wear those headsets, you know that you're present in, let's say, planet Earth. you know that you're present wherever you are at that point of time, but at the same time, you're also present wherever, you know, you are seeing visually as well. So it's very interesting that you have that you're able to be conscious or be present in two places at the same time. But one thing that I found interesting, and that's a personal experience for me, is how fear makes you feel. So let me just explain that for a second. So let's say if I'm playing a video game and I have my VR headsets on, I'm playing the game and I'm conscious that I'm playing the game and I know that I'm in this virtual world, but I also know that I'm in this physical world. Whereas once I went to this art installation, and so they had these VR headsets that people could wear. Some of them are different. Like one of them, you can see like paint murals of like of a church that the artist drew, which was fine. But then there was another one, and I'm very scared of heights, FYI, where you're in a very, very elevated place and you're like standing on top of this tall building. And I have to say, at that point of time, I felt, even if it was just for a few seconds, I really believed that I was at the top of this building and all my sensory signals, you know, whatever is firing my amygdala fear response, like it all just went triggered and I was in full on panic mode. And I genuinely, and I truly mean this, I genuinely believed at that point of time that I was in this reality and I completely forgot about my actual physical reality. And it just makes me think how different states, even when you're not like, when it's just your own wake and consciousness state, but a fear-induced state made you completely not be able to distinguish between your reality and your virtual reality. So I'm just curious what your thoughts are on VR.
Yeah, I mean, that's fantastic because I've worked precisely on this kind of issue, and I've had this experimental project that I haven't conducted yet, but to investigate something very similar to what you just described. So as I mentioned previously, I've been interested in self-consciousness and self-representation. And one of the forms of self-representation I've been interested in is this spatial form of self-representation. And so this sense that I have that I am located here with respect to various landmarks in my environment, various objects, you know, the mug over there, and the lamp over there, and the screen over there. And indeed, what's interesting about VR, virtual reality, is that if the technology is good enough, if you have a good enough headset with head tracking, low latency, a good enough resolution, and so on, you get this phenomenon that has come to be known as the sense of presence. You get this illusion of being present within the virtual environment, notwithstanding the fact that you know that you aren't really there. Because obviously you're not delusional. Exactly. It's not quite like, you know, it's not like a psychopathology. You don't actually believe in a more abstract sense that you are located in the virtual environment. You know that, for example, if I put a VR headset at home, I know that I'm at home in New York, and I might be in this virtual world that is very different in the headset. So it's quite interesting to think from a philosophical and psychological perspective about what this sense of presence is. So it's interesting that you use that term. You said when you were having that experience, you truly believe that you were in the virtual environment. And I totally get what you mean, because it's a very salient sense that one might have with some experiences that you're really there. VR has a way of tricking your brain into feeling that you're there. I would say, though, that from a, you know, if we are trying to be very specific, we might not want to call this a belief, in the sense that you, you know, if I ask you in that moment, where are you, you would be able to tell me that, you know, you still know that you're in a VR experience. You're not delusional. It's something that, so I think it's something that happens at the perceptual level, not at the level of belief. It's a perceptual, it's a form of perceptual illusion.
Absolutely.
Just the way, you know, we know we're familiar with like simpler forms of perceptual illusions, like the Meyer-Lyer illusion. Well, it's a much more sophisticated, involved, and immersive illusion. And you also touched on something that is, I think, interesting and important, namely that we tend to get more we're more susceptible to that illusion of presence in states of high arousal, meaning in terms of physiological arousal, meaning specifically in that case, fear. So where when you have a stimulus in VR that is fear-inducing in some way, and that could be being in a location in the virtual environment that is very high up in front of a cliff or something like that. There is this experience you can have with VR called the Planck experiment, or the Planck experience, where you take an elevator, you go to the top of a building, and then you have to walk on a virtual plank. And I love to do this with some friends and colleagues. I have a VR headset, and I love to try it. And I, it's very interesting to see people's reactions. Not to, obviously, the goal is not to traumatize people if they had the real fear of heights, but just to see the range of reactions. So you can even put a physical plank in your lab or at home on the ground, so that people already have the
what a mind fuck.
It is totally a mind fuck, because you're stepping. So you go up in the elevator, right, and then you step outside. You see this plank, and I tell people, go ahead, start walking. So you start stepping on it, and you feel with your feet in the real world. You feel the plank, and that completely tricks your brain. And I've seen people who told me, I can't do it. I can't skip walking. I know it's not real. I know I'm in your apartment right now. I know I'm not going to fall 300 meters or whatever, but I cannot keep going. I can't. And to me, that's really interesting. And so I've been interested in investigating how that works. And my hypothesis is that, you can explain at a low level how it works. You can have a story that involves binocular vision. You're getting various kinds of depth cues when you're in the VR headset, from the fact that you have streams for both of your eyes, right? So you have this kind of illusion of 3D vision that is not the same thing as looking at a screen. And so, there are also depth cues that are monocular that we have from without even having 2D vision. So when you see something coming towards you in a movie, sometimes people have a reaction, even if it's a 2D screen, right?
Yeah, so
you can also have cues about depth that can surprise you with a 2D screen, but it's way more immersive when you're in VR, because it's all around you and you get 3D perception. And when you move your head, when you move around, the world reacts accordingly. So if you shift your head, to turn your head to the right, the visual scene will shift accordingly to the left, in such a way that it feels like you're looking around. It doesn't feel like you're looking at a screen. So you can have, we understand very well how that works on a low level, but I'm more interested in the high level phenomenon that you have this illusion of presence. And the way in which I personally want to interpret that is as having, as being related to self-representation in perception, spatial self-representation specifically. So I think what's happening is that the low-level phenomenon that's giving you this illusion of depth perception and the fact that you have this positional tracking, that means that when you move your head around, the world reacts accordingly, means that your brain ends up representing your location in space as being at the point of origin of the virtual viewpoint in the virtual environment. So wherever is, the whatever perspective you're streaming to the headset, the location in the virtual environment of the particular perspective on the virtual scene, that's where your brain is once the illusion kicks in, representing your location as being. And yeah, I think there are ways to break that illusion. For example, if you break the positional tracking, so if all of a sudden when you move your head around, it's not changing the viewpoint in the headset. So you move your head and there is no corresponding change of the visual scene. That breaks the illusion. And suddenly you won't feel present in the environment anymore. Even though you're still getting the same depth cues, but you're not getting the appropriate connection to action. I think the key part of my account of this phenomenon, my hypothesis, is that it's that you have this connection between sensory input and action. So you have the right kind of action contingent feedback when you have head tracking. And what I mean by this is that when you're moving, you get visual feedback that is congruent with your actions.
Right.
You move your head to the right, you get visual shift to the left. And that is the key to the illusion, I think.
Wow, that's very, very interesting. What about perception, though? Like how important would you say just our general perception would be? Because you also mentioned that some people, for example, could not go forward and others could. And I mean, it might not be related at all. I guess that's what I'm asking you. Do you think it is? Because our perceptions also shape the way we see certain things, whether it's in a VR or not. So for example, in the same situation, one person will go forward over the plank and the other person won't, simply because of the way they perceive that situation to be. I guess what I'm trying to ask is that would a person's perception be determinant of their experience of it as well?
I mean, I suppose it could be if they have, for example, some deficits. So someone who lacks a depth perception. So people have some deficits of depth perception that might make the experience less immersive. But I think in the question of whether or not you would want to walk on the plank generally depends more on how much of a fear of height because basically the low-level illusion is very sticky and persistent and hard to control. So low-level illusion of presence is something that is not really under voluntary control. You can swap in and out of it, really. It's persistent, like a lot of visual illusions. You know, visual illusions, notoriously, you can know that it's an illusion, and that doesn't mean that you can prevent yourself from still seeing the illusion. When you see the Mullaly illusion with the two lines that are the same length but look like they are different lengths, knowing that it's an illusion doesn't change the fact that it's an illusion. That's what philosophers and some psychologists call the cognitive impenetrability of visual illusions. So they're not penetrable by cognition in the sense that your beliefs about what's going on in the illusion cannot affect how you perceive the illusion. I think it's the same with a sense of presence. You might very well know that it's an illusion. You might know everything there is to know about VR headsets. You might be a vision scientist or VR engineer. You still will be subject to the illusion. And then what makes the difference about whether you can take that step on the plank or not is how afraid you are of a similar situation in the real world. If you don't have a fear of heights, you might be able to override the signals that the illusion gives you and just, you know, tell yourself, it's not real, it's not real. I can just take that step. It's not real. Ignore it. You know, my brain is telling me danger, don't do this. But like, I'm, you know, trying to ignore it. A bit like that scene in The Matrix where I think, you know, Neo is trying to jump from one building to the other and has to like walk himself up, you know, thinking that it's not real and that it's all an illusion.
Raphael, as a final question, the first one will be unrelated since you brought up Matrix, but do you think we are living in a simulation or we could be living in a simulation? And then the second, on a more serious note, based on all of your research that you've been doing and are doing, do you think consciousness is beyond reality or beyond science? As in, do you think science will manage to demystify consciousness at some point?
Yeah, these are big, weighty questions, but I would say to the simulation question, I don't take that hypothesis very seriously. Personally, I don't think I would not ascribe a very high credence to the claim that we live in a simulation. But I will also say that I don't think if we did live in a simulation, it would change much about the way we interact or ought to interact with the world. There is a nice paper by David Chalmers, philosopher at NYU, on that topic for the listeners who are interested. So I don't think it would change very much anything about our experience of the world and what we what is morally permissible and all these questions. The other question, I mean, I certainly hope that we will eventually have a fairly sophisticated and well worked out scientific theory of consciousness. I think part of the issue right now is that hypotheses that people debate about consciousness are somewhat underdetermined by available evidence because a move that's available to consciousness scientists when there is some evidence that seems to discredit their views is to abandon certain background assumptions that mm-hmm. make this interpretation of the evidence weigh against their view. And the problem is that we don't have really an agreement around the core background assumption that everyone should consolidate around in the science of consciousness. So it's very cheap currently in the science of consciousness, as it were, to abandon background assumptions, which means that it's very hard to use experiments to rule out some hypothesis. There are theories of consciousness, but what we need is to solidify agreement around background right. assumptions to have experiments that are more decisive and are more determine what we believe about consciousness in a more compelling way. But I do think that we will get there. The neuroscience itself is still in its infancy in many ways. And as we get better models of the brain in general and various aspects of conscious experience, then we can hopefully assemble this together and solve this problem.
Right, absolutely. Dr. Rafael, thank you so, so much for your time. This was such a valuable and interesting conversation, giving myself and our listeners so much to think about and reflect on. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in and listening, and we'll catch you in the next episode.